On the 31st of July 2016, a video went viral on social media where a man was plummeting out of a plane from 25,000 feet without a parachute. His name was Luke Akins, and he didn't slip or fall out of the aeroplane or forget to put the parachute on before he jumped. It was all planned, he considered. He was going to jump from 25,000 feet and was going to plummet without a parachute and land on a cargo net, which was 60 metres up in the air, which was 30 metres by 30 metres wide. So from 25,000 feet high in the air, he was going to land on a net about 100 feet by 100 feet square. And as you watch the video, I remember doing so, and I saw it again quite recently, just holding your breath thinking, what on earth is going to happen? And then you see him landing in this net, and actually quite near the edge of the net. You think, gosh, he almost got it wrong there. And you think as you watch it, he's absolutely insane. He's absolutely ridiculous. In fact, he said so himself. When he was first suggested that he should do it, he said, no, the same thing with me for me, certainly not to do it, as I'm a husband and a father. But then 2 weeks later, he had changed his mind, and then he started doing all the plans and preparations for it. I mean, he must have backed himself pretty considerably. Like, he had weighed up the odds and backed up and worked out, thinking, yeah, this is going to be it. I'm going to get out of this alive. I mean, he must seriously back himself. He must have some serious faith. But from our point of view, we look at him and think, you're an absolute nutter. You're absolutely insane for doing something like that. It looks, from our point of view, it looks like it's blind faith, doesn't it? And I wonder if we ever, whether feel that or know that with other people who have that when it comes to Christianity. It's all just about a blind faith. You know, just having your eyes shut and hoping for the best. You've just got to believe. You've just got to have faith. And that's it. There's nothing much concrete to it. It's just sort of a feeling. And you've just got to have faith. And everything will be okay. And if it's not that view, and the other view then is in total contrary to that, is if one hasn't got any grounding at all, the other faith is the opposite extreme, wanting absolute maximum grounding, maximum concrete evidence for it. Only have a little bit more, and then I'll believe, and then I'll put my trust in Jesus Christ. I need to see a bit more of the evidence, and a bit more, and a bit more, and never it is quite enough. It's those two kind of sort of polarized views of faith, blind faith on one hand, an extreme amount of proof before faith on the other. This story goes back a long while of an elderly uncle in a family was about to take his first aeroplane flight. And he was very unsure about this whole thing about aeroplanes and very skeptical about the whole thing. But he's persuaded that he should take a flight, and he did. And afterwards he asked how he thought it went. And he said, well, it wasn't as bad as I thought it might have been. But I'll tell you this. I never did put all my weight down. And I just need a little bit more evidence. I'm really not going to back it fully because I just need to see a bit more proof. And it's those two views of faith that often we see in the world around us. Maybe it's one of those two views that our friends have or our colleagues have or people we know or we're trying to tell about Jesus. Maybe it's a view we have ourselves. A little bit of blind faith, just hoping for the best and trusting. Or I just need a bit more proof. I just need a bit more evidence. And then I'll really trust. Then I'll really have faith. But what is true faith? Because that's what we're thinking about as we step back into the pages of Hebrews in our series on our morning service. What is true faith? And Martin Luther, the great reformer, he said, well, look, faith is everything. God, our Father, Martin Luther said, God, our Father, has made all things depend on faith. So that whatever without faith, with faith we'll have everything, but without faith we'll have nothing. With faith we'll have everything, but without faith we will have nothing. And of course the faith that Luther is talking about, it isn't a blind faith, it isn't an extreme amount of proof for faith, but it's this faith. It's faith, chapter 11, verse 1. Faith in confidence. Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. It is a God-based faith. It's a faith that holds to God, revealed in Jesus Christ, his Son, and in his Word. So we have here the writer of the Hebrews writing to the the Hebrew Christians, they were Jews and have come to put their trust in Jesus. But times are hard, they're facing opposition and persecution and difficulty. And often, as it happens, and maybe we find ourselves doing it, we go back to what we know, and they've gone back, or being tempted to go back to their old Jewish habits, their old Jewish traditions. And so the writer of the Hebrews presses on them not to turn back, but instead says, Jesus is better, don't forget it. Jesus is better, don't forget it. That's our big theme for the whole letter of Hebrews. And in chapter 10, which we're looking back over the last few weeks, we're reminded how Jesus is the ultimate high priest, and how the writer implores his readers to stick to Jesus, to stick to Jesus and not go back to their own ways, and have, in chapter 11, faith. And it's only when he gets to chapter 11 that he hits the pause button. He's doing all this teaching about who Jesus is and how we're to persevere in faith, and then suddenly it's almost like he takes a sidestep and starts talking about men and women of the Old Testament and of their faith and trust in God. And as we read through this, and if we were to read the whole of chapter 11, you could find yourself thinking, well, it's a bit of a random list, isn't it? You know, he just lists through all of these people. And like, you know, he might do a shopping list, right? Start with Adam, then Abel, and then Noah. Oh, forgot Enoch, put Enoch in. Abraham, he was big, so put lots of Abraham in. Jacob, Joseph, of course, you know, one of the 12, yeah, all the King David, big king. But it's not that. It's not a random list of just a collection of some men and women, which gets very general towards the end of chapter 11, but it's specific. It's really specific of teaching about true faith. True faith that points to Jesus. That backs up all of his teaching up to this point, saying, look, stick to Jesus. Stick to Jesus. Jesus is better. Don't forget it. And so in our verses that we're looking at today, it's all about the future. It's all about the future. Previously, in the first bit of chapter 11, he's been talking about how to have a true faith in God. And later on, it's going to be about how to have faith in the light of suffering and the light of difficulty. But here in our verses, he puts the context of what faith is and where faith should be pointing. And it is the future. It is the future. By faith, verse 8, by faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. Verse 13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on the earth. They're looking forward. They're looking to the future. And the future's bright. The future is God's heavenly country. The future's bright. The future's God's heavenly country. And when we're reading through bits of the Bible, like Hebrews 11, and I guess actually the whole of the Old Testament, it's worth having on our minds how we read it. How do we read these verses, these pages of Scripture? Because it's easy to read through, and we're going to read through it about Abraham and think, right, okay, well, I'll be like Abraham. And a bit, okay, I'll be like Sarah. Okay, I'll be like Isaac. I'll be like, and actually, and same for the Old Testament, but that's not the primary thing we are to do. Because if we're going to be like Abraham or Isaac or Jacob, we're going to get ourselves in a whole pickle of a situation when Abraham lies about his wife in order to save his own back when he goes to Egypt. Or Jacob, who pretends to be Esau in order to get his father's blessing. Or King David, adultery, lying, murder. No, we're not primarily to be like these men and women of faith in the Old Testament. We learn from their example. But the first thing we see, the first thing we have to look for is God. Not what do we learn about Abraham and all the other others listed, but what do we learn about God? And to be more like God. And actually, it is God and his son Jesus who is the ultimate example who we are to be like. That is where this whole little section accumulates and concludes in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, that we are to be like Jesus, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, chapter 12, verse 2. So as we look at these verses, let's look for two things of God, and we see two things here. We see God's plan, and we see God's promise. We see God's plan, and we see God's promise. So firstly, God's plan, the certain heavenly city to come. The certain heavenly city to come. God's plan. Verse 8, let's look again. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Now, the writer is recalling the first events that happened to Abraham. Abraham being called by God, and Abraham leaving and following, going to the land that God had promised him. And Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, although they're living in the promised land, they didn't deem themselves to be possessing it. That they were looking ahead to something further ahead, that they were looking to something brighter, a future. So that's why they lived in tents. Tents, as we thought about with the children at the beginning, are temporary. They are movable. You can pack them up, you can put them down, move them from one place to another place. They're quick to put up, unless you're me, and very easy to put down, again, unless you're like me. I mean, you go to a campsite on your holiday, you don't see buildings everywhere, do you? You know, some people getting their bricks and mortar out, they put up their tents, poles and canvas. Or poles, apparently, are passé now, and it's all about pumping air into air poles, which are apparently stronger and even easier. And the greats of the Old Testament of faith, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the rest, they lived in tents that were temporary because they were looking to a future city, a future city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. And that's quite a startling contrast, isn't it, between tents, how temporary they are, and cities, how permanent, how strong, and how secure they are, and the architect of them, verse 10, it is God. It is God. And it is God who is preparing a city for them, verse 16. Have a look at that, verse 16. Instead, they are longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Looking for a better country within which would be the better heavenly city. That's God's plan. And this is heavyweight terminology in what he's using here in verse 16, with that they were longing, like groaning, like a child with groaning, longing for Christmas to come so they can open their presents, even though it's only February. They're longing, they're groaning for it, for a better country. For a better country, a heavenly one. A better country. Now, better is one of those key words that we see again and again through the book, the letter to the Hebrew Christians. And each time it's pointing to Jesus, that Jesus is the better angel. That Jesus, in chapter 7, is the better hope. That Jesus is the better covenant. That Jesus is the better high priest and sacrifice, chapter 9. And so for the Old Testament believers, they anticipate a better possession than their tents. A better homeland than canvas and poles. A heavenly city in a heavenly country where God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And it's a heavenly city, which again is a term used very intentionally, and it's rooted in Old Testament writing. And of course, the Old Testament great city of Jerusalem. I mean, that was the promise, wasn't it, to the Israelites, that God was going to give them the promised land with the promised city, Jerusalem. And they entered the promised land after exile in Egypt. And then King David brought them into Jerusalem. And it was the best times for God's people in the Old Testament of peace, prosperity, with God's King David on the throne. And it was Jerusalem. But of course, that wasn't going to last. That wasn't going to last. And then throughout the rest of the Old Testament, by the prophets, are pointers to an even greater Jerusalem. An even greater Jerusalem. I mean, it's pointed to by the prophet Nathan, to David himself, that there's going to be an everlasting king who's going to sit on his throne in 2 Samuel 7. But through the rest of the prophets, we see that there's promises of there's going to be an even greater Jerusalem that will be an everlasting kingdom. That even greater Jerusalem that will be the center of the universe. An even greater Jerusalem that will be holy where there'll be forgiveness, where there'll be comfort, where there'll be security, where there'll be joy, and it will be a massive, huge, incredible, and glorious, and wonderful blessing by God. Because, chapter 11, verse 16, God is not ashamed to be called their God. He has prepared a city for them. Isn't that incredible? And the Hebrew Christians, they know this. They were steeped in all of this teaching from the Old Testament. They were brought up as Jews, good, faithful Jews. They would have known all these prophecies. They would have known all this teaching about this greater Jerusalem, this heavenly city to come. And now they're being taught it and seeing it even more. The future is bright. The future is God's heavenly city. That's God's plan. That is God's plan, the certain heavenly city to come. But what is striking is that the men and women of faith that the writer writes about in verse 13, they aren't all of these later people of the Old Testament. It is these early saints from Abel through to Isaac and Joseph. But all these people, verse 13, were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. But yet the Hebrew Christians, and we, of course, see it even more clearer. We have even more clarity on it. That's God's plan, the certain heavenly city to come. So look forwards, not back. So look forwards, not back. Look forwards to the return of Jesus. To the coming of that heavenly city that's spoken about in Revelation 22. Of that day when that city will arrive with Jesus sitting on the judgment seat will come, and he will open the doors to the new heavens and the new earth and will bring that heavenly country, that heavenly city. I mean, what a future, what a hope that is. How incredible that that is what is on offer. What God out of love gives in his son Jesus. An old friend of my father's was dying of cancer, and in the last couple of months of his life, my dad went to go and see him. My dad's a Christian, and his friend was a Christian as well. My dad went to go and ask him about, you know, to go see how he is and pray with him and talk to him. And he said, "Tony, how are you feeling about what's to come?" And Tony said to my dad, "John, I just can't wait. I just can't wait." He can't wait for that heavenly city. He can't wait to be at home with the Lord. He can't wait to be in that city that God has prepared for him. That city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. You see, that's faith. That's faith grounded in God. That's faith looking to the future. So look forwards, not back. John Calvin once wrote that faith isn't a distant view, but a loving embrace of Christ. And that's what it is. It's not a distant view of God, but a loving embrace of Christ. And so these men and women of faith, verse 13, they didn't look backwards, they looked forwards. Looking forwards, not back. Verse 13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. But if they'd been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return to it. Instead, they're longing for a better country, a heavenly one. See, look forwards, not back. Abraham and his descendants, they had received these promises. They had received these promises from God, and they died in faith. And they were looking to God's plan. They were looking to God's future. And so they considered themselves to be foreigners, strangers, and didn't claim to be living by the rules of this world, but living by God's way, because knowing their future was set on him. Thinking and looking towards that heavenly country. Not that they left. They'd been looking back, they'd been thinking what they left, they had a return, but instead they're looking, they're focused on that. It's like if you're going on holiday this summer and you're going to go on a beach holiday, you get ready for it, don't you? You make your list and you pack and all that kind of stuff. You don't pack your skis when you're going on a beach holiday. You don't pack your winter coat unless it's Cornwall. You don't pack your winter coat and everything when you're going on a nice sunny holiday. You get ready for it. They live in the light of their future. And that is what we are to do. To live in the light of our future. Look forwards, not back. Live in the light of Christ's return. Live in the light of the certain heavenly city to come. Because that is our trajectory. As believers in Jesus Christ, trusting in him in faith, that is where we're looking. That is what trajectory, what path we're on. We look back and we see the cross and the resurrection and the ascension. And we look ahead and we see the gates of glory and the heavenly city. And that is where we're focused. And that is where we look to. And that is what we want to live in the light of. Which puts a whole different framework when it comes to battling with sin. There's not something I must try and stop doing or something I must start trying to do. That is my future. It's already been paid for and taken by Christ. And that is my future. So I want to live in the light of that. Know that one day I'm going to be living like that in eternity. And in fact, he's already made me pure and holy and right. And so I'm on this trajectory. And also I want to be saying, my friends, come and join me on this path. It is amazing. Look at this heavenly city we're going to have and we're going to enjoy together. You've got to know this. You've got to know this. Come find about who Jesus is. Come put your trust in him. Come and join me on this trajectory, on this path to eternity. So look forwards, not back. That's God's plan. The certain heavenly city to come. So look forwards, not back. And that plan is based in God's promise. God's promise that he's faithful to his plan, even when it seemed impossible. God's promise is spoken about a number of times through our verses. And it's the promises that he gave to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12 and then built on. So in chapter 12, I'm just going to remind you what they are. God told Abraham, go from your country and your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you'll be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. A threefold promise that God was giving Abraham and his descendants. A great land, a great nation, great people, and great blessing. Land, people, blessing. And then as through Abraham's ministry and walking to the promised land, that promise is developed and grown in chapter 15, chapter 17, and chapter 22 of Genesis. And we see it described, of course, in our verses here, verse 12. And so from this one man, and as he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. That Abraham was going to be the father of this huge nation, this huge people. More descendants than there are stars in the sky. And then there are grains of sand on the seashore. That was God's promise. Living out to bring about his plan. His plan of that heavenly city. And God is faithful to his promises. If we were to read through the chapters of Genesis, we would see it again and again, how God is faithful to his plan, despite Abraham getting things wrong. Despite situations seeming so impossible. And we see one there as an example for us in verse 12 with Sarah. Verse 11. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was unable to bear children, because she considered him faithful, who had made the promise. God kept his word. God kept his promise. Even when it seemed impossible. Because God is the God of the impossible. When Sarah overheard a conversation from three angels saying that she was going to be with child when she was way beyond childbearing age, she laughed. She laughed. Laughed in indignation, thinking this is ridiculous. That cannot happen. Yet God was faithful and God gave her a child, Isaac. And she laughed again with joy, seeing God's faithfulness to his promise and to his word. And again, we see it with Abraham and Isaac over the page in verse 17. So verse 17, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He had embraced the promises, was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. So God had given Abraham and his wife Sarah their one and only child, Isaac. And then God told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And Abraham trusted in faith. He trusted in God's promise. And in fact, he's seen it countless times already, how God had been faithful in keeping his promise. And he trusted that God would do it again. So much so that if we were to read the account, when they get to the mountain where Abraham's going to go up with Isaac to sacrifice him, Abraham says to the servants with him, "Look, we will worship and then we will come back to you," in Genesis 22 verse 5. "We will worship and then we'll come back to you." And I'll take that not trying to worry his servants about what was about going to happen, but he was speaking out of faith. He was speaking in trust in God's promises, that he's faithful to his plan, even when it seems impossible. Abraham was convinced that Isaac, he would return. He would return. And that God would keep his promise. God would keep his word. And see how it's described. It's very interesting in verse 19. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Because it was the point of death where the angel of the Lord intervened. Abraham there with the dagger, literally about to cut open Isaac and sacrifice on the altar. When the angel of the Lord intervened. And so you can see that, can't you? Isaac, he returned, he was resurrected, brought back from the dead, just as Jesus died and was risen back to life. Just as Abraham was willing to sacrifice his one and only son, God did sacrifice his one and only son at the cross. Because God has a plan, and God keeps his promise. And he's faithful to his plan, even when it seems impossible. God is the God of the impossible, faithful to his plan, when it even seems impossible. He is a man of his word. He keeps his word. Lindsay and I, over the years, we've enjoyed watching 24, Jack Bauer, the central figure of the CTU, and one of his catchphrases, Jack Bauer, that is repeatable, is, "You have my word. You have my word." And he always does whatever it is in order to keep his word, to keep his promise, to whatever he's promised to save or whatever he's promised to do. And God always, he always keeps his word. God gives his word, his promise, and he keeps it. So trust in him. God's promise, he's faithful in his plan, even when it seems impossible. So trust in him. That is the God we can have faith in. That is the God we can trust in. When everything seems to be going wrong, we can trust that God has a plan and God's promise is true and he keeps his word. That when Jesus, in his final words to the disciples in the Great Commission at the end of Matthew's Gospel, says, "Look, go make disciples of all nations and surely I'll be with you to the end of the age." Those words are true. They're not hollow. God hasn't left us. We're not alone. Or the promise Paul makes of Christ in Philippians chapter 1 verse 5, that Christ will bring that work they started us to completion in the day of Christ Jesus. That's not false. That's not a lie. That's not just empty words of comfort Paul is trying to comfort Philippian Christians by in their persecution. He's reminding them, no, God and his son Jesus got you and he will keep you. Even when it seems impossible. God is the God of the impossible, so we can trust in him. So that means we can look to our friends around us or people around us and we think they are so far, so incredibly far from Jesus. Now, Lindsay and I were just thinking about someone last night. They're so far from Jesus, but they're not. Because God is the God of the impossible who can save them, who can open their eyes to him. And that can give us boldness to go and tell people about Jesus. That can give us boldness in wanting to speak of him. It means we don't need to give up in despair when we're feeling like, I've got this wrong in my life again, this sin that I keep on doing and keep falling back into. A lust thing or an anger thing or a pride thing, whatever it is. It doesn't need to defeat me because it's already been taken by Jesus because of the future I have with him. And those words are true. They are not hollow because God is with us by his Spirit. God's love is on us in his Son, Jesus. And when everything seems to be going wrong, we can know that God is with us. That is faith. It's not an empty faith. It's not a blind faith. It's not a faith on, I just need a bit more evidence until I believe and trust it. It is a God-grounded, God-based faith. It's based and focused in God's plan. God's plan of that heavenly city. And it's based in God's promise that he is faithful to his plan, even when it seems impossible. The future's bright, and the future is God's heavenly city.